I'm Dan Rundy. This is another edition of Building the Future with Dan Rundy. I'm here with my friend Bob Kagan, who has written, I think, the most important foreign policy book of 2018, The Jungle Grows Back, America and Our Imperiled World. Bob, thank you so much for doing this.
Thank you for having me, Dan. It's great to be here.
Absolutely. So The Jungle Grows Back. Why did you call this book The Jungle Grows Back?
Well, I'm using this metaphor. I'm basically, if you think about the liberal world order as a garden, if you plant a garden, you know that you can't just walk away and come back a week later and expect it to still be there, because there are forces of nature that are constantly working to overrun it and undermine it. There are weeds and the vines that need to be fought back if you want to keep your garden intact. And that's basically the way I look at this world order that the United States created after World War II. It's not something that's natural. It didn't just evolve because human nature evolved in any way. It was something that was created, and it was something that needs to be sustained. And there are forces of nature that are constantly working against it, forces of human nature and the nature of the international system, which tends toward chaos and conflict. And so if we want to maintain this order and all the benefits that we have derived from it, we need to be constantly working at it.
So, Bob, we just did a public event here at CSIS that talked about your book. There are some certain things that mark this liberal order. What are the things that make this unique?
Basically, three things that make it unique, and any one of them by itself would be extraordinary, but the three of them together are truly extraordinary. One has been the incredible prosperity of this period. I mean, we've enjoyed something like 4% GDP annual global growth, which compared to the rest of history is just...
It's off the charts.
It's unimaginable. As you know, most people throughout history have lived in a state of abject poverty. And for this many people to enjoy economic success, 4 billion people have lifted themselves out of poverty in this period into the largest middle class that the world has ever seen.
Today, there are more wealthy and middle class people in the world than poor people. That's unheard of in human history. It's off the charts.
Right. And we take that for granted, unfortunately. So that's extraordinary. The other thing, of course, and very obvious to all of us, is the incredible spread of democracy. If you look again at the whole sweep of human history, 99.99% of the world's population has lived under one form of tyranny or another. Democracy was the rarest form of government. And since World War II, we've seen an explosion of democracy to the point where there are over 100 democracies in the world today. That makes this period incredibly special. And then finally, and I think related to these other two, there's been an absence of the kind of great power war that we saw twice at the beginning of the 20th century in World War I and World War II, that we saw in the 19th century in the Napoleonic War, that we saw in the 30 Years' War of the 17th century, the kind of cataclysmic conflicts that not only lead to the deaths of tens of millions of people of the combatants, but also decimate the entire global economy. So we've been spared that. And so all three of those things together make this period absolutely unique. And I think, unfortunately, it's almost been too successful for its own good, because I think people have just decided, well, this is the norm. This is the way things are destined to be, that we've had some kind of evolution of the species, when in fact, it's an aberration, it's temporary, and it's extremely fragile.
We ought to pinch ourselves every day that we live in this period in many ways.
Right. And again, it was something that was created out of a world war. It was created by American power. And unfortunately, for better or for worse, it can only be sustained by American power.
So what happens if we take our foot off the gas?
Well, we've been taking our foot off the gas, and we're seeing some of the results. We see rising nationalism in Europe and increasing tribalism around the world. We see dictators like Mohammed bin Salman in Saudi Arabia carrying out grisly executions in another country. You know, we're seeing what happens when the lid comes off. We see a resurgent China. We see a resurgent Russia. And if you really want to know where this is all going, just look at what the world looked like before we established this order. Look at the world of the first half of the 20th century, where we saw the worst inhumanity that anyone had ever imagined.
In essence, the liberal order was not set up in response to communism, right?
There's a couple of misconceptions about this order that created after World War II. One was that it was a response to communism and the Cold War. It was not. It was actually a response to everything that had happened leading up to World War II. It was mostly designed during World War II when we thought the Soviets were going to be an ally afterwards.
The Bretton Woods Conference was held in 1944. The San Francisco Conference, I think, was held in 1944, early
1945, but before anyone thought the Soviet Union was going to be any kind of an adversary. And I think that this leads to the second misconception, which is that we were just trying to create a world that would just be a better world for everybody, that it was an idealistic venture. But in fact, as we've been saying, it was a very pessimistic response to what had already happened, the two world wars of the first half of the
20th century. This was a clear-eyed, this was a vision.
It was realist. It was true realism in the sense that they had the founders of this order, from Dean Acheson to Franklin Roosevelt to Harry Truman, they had seen the worst that humanity had to offer. They were under no illusions about what people were capable of, and they wanted to erect a system and structures and a power structure that would contain and prevent those worst elements of human nature from manifesting themselves again.
If I recall correctly, I could be wrong, but I think Roosevelt was at the Versailles Conference.
I don't know. He might have been. It's possible. He certainly was working for Wilson. He was Assistant Secretary of the Navy during the Wilson administration.
He was around. He kind of had like a 50-yard seat on sort of the
errors.
It's
entirely possible.
Let's call it Globalization 1.0.
He was a witness to both the triumph of World War I and to the disaster that followed when the United States walked away. Right.
Okay. So in the public session, we had a conversation. You were talking about the deal we make with the world, in essence, out of The Godfather. And you basically just described that.
For those of you who remember Godfather Part 2, there's a character called Hyman Roth. And the saying about Hyman Roth is that he lived as long as he did because he always made money for his partners. And in a way, I think that's been one of the great successes of American foreign policy, is that those who've joined our order, those who've taken part in it with us, like Germany and Japan and many others, have done well. And in return for that, they've essentially given up their traditional geopolitical ambitions. They've not gotten us into wars again, which Germany and Japan had done over and over again before this. And we basically said, you do well economically, you become successful, and then, but give up your military and geopolitical ambitions. And that is really, if you ask what is the core of the liberal world order, that bargain is at the core of it.
So I'm going to quote several things from your book, and I just want you to react to some. On page 135, you say, the common assumption that the U.S. cannot possibly sustain its position in East Asia in the face of a rising China overestimates Chinese strength and underestimates America's persistent strategic advantages. What do you mean by that?
Yeah, I mean, so many people have become convinced that the rise of China is both a steady, unstoppable reality.
Juggernaut.
Right. That, whatever we've seen in the last 20 years is what we're going to see in the next 20 years, which, by the way, history tells us is not the case. But also that the United States clearly does not have the capacity to prevent China from essentially reestablishing its hegemony in the region. I think that's just completely wrong. China faces enormous strategic obstacles, not least of which is it is surrounded on all sides by very powerful countries like India and Japan and South Korea and Australia, all of which get nervous about China's rise, all of which have tremendous capacity themselves, and all of which have strategic relationships with the United States. I would not trade our position for China's for any money.
So you'd rather be us than them?
I would rather be us than them.
And every day of the week.
And that doesn't get into the question whether China is stable politically. I think it's very interesting as we watch Xi Jinping assume all power. Is this a stabilizing effort? Is this going to lead to stability in China or instability? I would say that when China was governed by the collective leadership of the Communist Party, it probably was more stable than when all power is concentrated in the hands of one man.
So you were talking earlier about what does the deal look like with China? You were talking about economics and military. Just talk a little bit about some of that.
Well, in a perfect world, I would say we should not stand in the way of China becoming economically successful. What we should stand in the way of is their using their economic success, translating it into military power, and then using their military to gain geopolitical advantages, whether against Taiwan or against Japan or in the South China Sea. In a way, I would offer the Chinese the same bargain that we offered to Germany and Japan, and for that matter, Britain and France after World War II, which is prosper economically, lift the well-being of your people, just no more use of military power to get your way. And that requires two things. One is that we continue to have a relatively fair international economic system on the one hand. On the other, that we're strong enough militarily so that it never looks like a good option for the Chinese to turn to military force to achieve their objectives.
Yeah, what I'm worried about and what you raised earlier was, what if it's the opposite? If we're squeezing them economically and we're not backing it up with force, that's not such a great equation.
And that's what I'm worried we may be doing right now. I mean, I'm not opposed to driving a tough bargain with the Chinese on trade. They do cheat on trade deals. They are stealing our intellectual property, and we should be tough with them on that. On the other hand, we have to realize that unlike when we're dealing with an ally like Canada, who basically has to either put up with what we are demanding or try to negotiate the best deal they can, China does have another option. It has a military option. And so at the same time that we're squeezing them, we need to be strong militarily. Unfortunately, we're now moving in the opposite direction. The new defense budget that Trump is calling for will lead to de facto cuts in our capability. Congress does not seem to have any desire to increase our defense spending sufficiently to deter China, and that'll be true especially if the Democrats take control of the House. So we are now in a position of squeezing them economically but not deterring them militarily, and I worry that's a dangerous position to be in.
Page 154, it took great and consistent exertions of American power and influence to create and sustain this world order. It will take no less to continue upholding it into the future. Americans over the past two decades have become convinced that the U.S. is doing too much when actually it has been doing too little.
Yeah, this order that we were describing before, this incredibly peaceful, democratic, and prosperous order, was the product to a very large extent of tremendous exertion of American power and influence all across the globe, in Europe, in Asia, in the Middle East, in Latin America, and elsewhere. And for us to imagine that we can still have the same benefits, even though we do less, that's a kind of a fairy tale that unfortunately a lot of very respected scholars are selling Americans these days. We can do less and it's all going to be fine. But that isn't even logical, and it certainly isn't the case. And I think what we've seen over the past couple of decades, and certainly this was a response to Iraq and Afghanistan and the financial crisis, which led first the Obama administration and now the Trump administration to say, look, we've got to do less in the world. We don't have to do everything for everybody else. We are seeing the consequences of that. We are seeing an increasingly out of control world. We're seeing increasingly a retreat of democracy around the world. We're seeing an increase in geopolitical competition around the world. Others are responding to the degree to which we're pulling back and filling the vacuum that we're leaving.
Okay, page 156. Members of Congress from both parties have underfunded the military since the beginning of the post-Cold War era. Most of what we need to do to sustain the liberal order will not require sending troops, but there will be times when it will be necessary. It is simply dishonest to tell the American people that the relative security and prosperity they have enjoyed can be sustained without the occasional threat or use of force.
It may not be very popular to say it, but I'm not going to sit here and say that we can have everything we want and there's no cost to it. I think that
there's no free lunch.
And that, I mean that in a very, you know, in a very serious sense. Obviously, we're talking about lives that are lost, the expense of, you know, not just
blood and treasure.
Absolutely. And we have done so. And by the way, we have made terrible mistakes. I mean, if you want to look at Vietnam, it was a mistake the way we fought it. On the other hand, the overall strategy that it was carried out in pursuit of containment was successful. And so even a successful policy is going to have its share of mistakes.
So you were saying earlier that there's no such thing as an error-free foreign policy.
That's right. And I think, unfortunately, when people, you know, read these alternative approaches than the one I'm offering, just take a look and see whether anyone is talking about what the potential downsides of their strategy are.
Almost never.
I think I'm very upfront that there are going to be downsides to the strategy I'm proposing because human beings are fallible. America makes mistakes. You don't know in advance whether something's going to work out just because you'd like it to. And so when you undertake military action, some percentage of the time, it's not going to have the outcome you want it to have. But the alternative of doing nothing will lead to a much worse outcome. And that's the sort of cost-benefit analysis that it's very hard to make, but I think Americans have to make. They have to understand what the costs of not taking action are as well as what the costs of acting are.
Who's responsible for educating the American people on this?
Well, ultimately, of course, it's our political leaders. If you think about who was responsible for educating the American people at the time of the Civil War, who did it? It was Abraham Lincoln and some other politicians, but it's our political leaders. And unfortunately, much of the time, and I think this is normal in a democracy, American political leaders try to tell Americans what they think they want them to hear. If they think the Americans are in a mood for not engaging in the world, then they tell them they don't have to engage in the world. And by the way, that's what we saw in the 1920s and 30s. You had even an internationalist like Franklin Roosevelt spent his first term in office telling Americans that they didn't have to get involved in the world because that's what they wanted to hear. And so you need a certain amount of courage as a political leader to get out there and start warning, as someone like Winston Churchill did in the 1930s, that this is the road to disaster if we don't take the necessary steps.
Are there Republicans and Democrats today who are willing to be courageous about this?
I'm not seeing a lot of them, honestly. Right now, we're in a partisan battle.
We have a midterm election tomorrow.
Right, and that doesn't make for a lot of independence within parties. You're not going to see, I mean, for instance, I believe that I'm not the only person who thinks that Trump is not going to be spending enough on defense. I'm sure a senator like Tom Cotton thinks that too.
You must think that too.
And Lindsey Graham, I bet, thinks that too. I don't hear them saying it right now. Well, okay, let's have an election, get the election passed, and then see what they do. I saw a lot of tough talk from Republicans when Obama was president. I see much less of it since Trump has been president.
Page 158, the more we rely on proxies like Saudi Arabia, Egypt, and Israel to determine the course of events in the Middle East, the less it will be a course we would choose. For the U.S., it is not a question of all in or all out. In the Middle East and elsewhere, we will still be required to make decisions when to intervene, how to intervene, how much to commit, and how long to stay, and the answers will not be obvious and the outcomes will not be certain or even predictable. Those who insist on outcomes that pose no further dangers and require no further involvement are asking the impossible.
Well, it's sort of the point we were discussing before, which is if people want understandably, we want a perfect foreign policy, but nothing else in our lives is perfect. If you're a lawyer and you lose a case, you don't say, well, that's it. I'm not going to be a lawyer anymore. You try to do better next time. And I wish we spent more time trying to learn from our mistakes than hoping that we will never make a mistake.
So it's like batting 1,000 in foreign policy. Nobody bats 1,000 in foreign policy.
Right. I said this in a previous book. If you get it right 30% of
the
time in
baseball,
you go to the Hall of Fame.
Yeah.
And that's true in foreign policy too. If you get it right 30% of the time, you're probably in the Hall of Fame for foreign policy because we're dealing with human interactions. These are the hardest things in the world to get right. It's not a science.
So let me just remind everybody, this: we're talking about The Jungle Grows Back, America and Our Imperiled World. It's by Bob Kagan, who's with me today. I consider this the most important foreign policy book of 2018. Bob, I just want you to reiterate, what are the benefits we have gotten out of this deal? This has been a great deal for the United States. It's been a great deal for our allies. Why is this worth fighting for? Why is this worth all the costs that we've talked about?
Well, the key thing in making any assessment like that is compared to what? Because I think a lot of times people can think of all the ways in which the world could be better for us. You know, we could be making fewer sacrifices and spending less money. But in the real world, the real alternative is not things that are better. The real alternative is things that are much worse. And all you have to do is look at the world that existed before 1945 and compare it to the world after 1945.
And so I'm going to use a technical term. It sucked. It was tough.
Well,
was,
and
it
we
was
got
a lot
to,
of
and we were
brutal debt, like right. Millions of dead, and it just it was just
and,
a chaotic.
And from a purely selfish American point of view, which is what, by the way, the founders of this world order were thinking in purely selfish America. They weren't trying to do a favor for the rest of the world.
Oh,
they were looking
us.
Out for us because we had been dragged into two world wars against our will.
And we're sick of it.
And we didn't want a third world war. And essentially, that's what they tried to set up, a system of economic rules, of political tendencies, and a strategic basis to prevent the world sliding back into the chaos and conflict that Americans had experienced twice in the first half of the 20th
century.
Because
they didn't want to do it a third time.
Exactly. And so when you say, you know, what is
it? Did it work? It worked.
It worked, and it has worked. And at the same time, America has grown rich. We may not be as rich this decade as we wished we were, but let's face it, if you look at where America was before World War II and where America has gone since then, we're still the richest, most prosperous people in the world. We have the highest standard of living. Maybe somebody in Sweden thinks they have a higher standard of living, but that's not, you know, we've done very well in this world, and most importantly, we've not been had to face a world once again that was collapsing. And I think a lot of Americans think, well, the world can collapse and it won't affect us. And that's exactly what we thought in the 1930s.
Pearl Harbor.
Right.
Pearl Harbor. Okay. Bob, this is great. I'm such a fan. I just keep writing, keep doing what you're doing. You've got a big fan in me. I'm a believer, and this is just, like I said, I think this is the most influential foreign policy book of 2018. Thank you, Bob.
Well, you're very kind, Dan, and thanks for having me on your show. Appreciate it.